Well, welcome and thank you all very much for coming. It's great to see such a nice big audience. What I'd like to do, I don't intend to speak for more than an hour, less I hope, stop me if I go on too much. I'd like to sketch out the book's main arguments, but in the process of thinking about this evening and what I'd say, inevitably I think I made one or two new connections which I'll try and weave in. And I'll certainly be showing some images which aren't in the book, but which you will be able to find most of on a website. But perhaps that process of making new connections is a bit like what can happen in psychotherapy or in an analysis. A period of gestation is needed before the obvious can make itself known. So I'm very grateful to Carol and the Freud Museum and to you for this opportunity. And, of course, to my splendid publishers, Carnac, who've done such a good job with this cover, I think. Well, I hope you agree they're powerful, arresting portraits. And mysterious, in more ways than one. What are the bare facts about them? Well, they were painted by Théodore Géricault in Paris in the years around 1820. They're now in 5 different public collections in Paris, Lyon, Ghent, Winterthur in Switzerland, and Springfield, Illinois. Beyond this, there's not an awful lot that we can say for sure about them. They were probably painted in 1822 to 23. I think they were. Or was it 1819? Others think then. There are various theories about the reasons and even the circumstances in which they were painted, and we'll talk about some of them in a minute. We can be pretty sure that the female figures were patients in the great hospital asylum, the Salpêtrière in Paris, which was the great women's hospital. The men possibly from the men's hospital at Bicêtre, or possibly from a private clinic. The portraits themselves, which I should say now are life-size, you're seeing them slightly larger than life-size, seem to have disappeared soon after they were made, and they weren't discovered again until 40 years later, in 1863, in an attic, in a trunk, in Baden-Baden. They were taking the waters, perhaps. Their titles, they're known as monomaniacs, refers to a, by 1863, pretty much defunct medical category. And the titles come from their owner's memory. The owner was a retired doctor. So even these titles are not entirely certain. Their owner in 1863 had been an intern at the Salpêtrière when he was a young man, under a young doctor, or alienist, as he would have called himself, called Étienne Georget, who himself died a long time before in 1828. Originally, apparently, there were 10 of these portraits. Georget, who was their first owner, gave the other 5 to another intern who took them back to Brittany, where they vanished. Perhaps they'll turn up in an attic in Brittany one day. That would be something. So they challenge and confront us on all sorts of levels. Not least because we are without the protection of supposed knowledge about them, except the rather chilling historical diagnosis, which describes basically a condition in which a person can be mad on only one subject. And you'll be curious to know what these are monomaniacs of. This man is the monomaniac of theft, but he also gathered the title later in his life of the mad murderer, le fou assassin. This is a monomaniac of gambling. I find it horrible talking about them in this way, but these are the titles that the paintings are given. Monomaniac of gambling, or a woman ruined by the lottery. A monomaniac of military command. You could have guessed that one, probably. Monomaniac of envy. The slide is too hot. It's not all of these reproductions are very poor, but this one is not quite as hot in colour as this. And this man this very sad-looking individual, is a monomaniac of the abduction of children. So if we were to give him a contemporary title, it would be very shocking. He'd be the paedophile, probably. But they also raise broader existential questions. Who are these people? We know absolutely nothing about them. Although, as John Berger said, everything about them suggests that Jericho would have known their names. Beyond this, who is this enigmatic other the portraits confront us with? They give very little away. They have very few of the attributes of traditional portraiture. You know, if you're a duke, you have your ducal sash or sword or something. Who are these people? How are we to respond? These are urgent questions, of course, faced in the consulting room, moment to moment. Who is this person? How do I respond? Who am I talking to? But they're more generally urgent questions today in an era of refugees and mass migration, deep suspicions of the stranger, especially when our government, since yesterday, seems publicly to have decided that immigrants are to blame. In some ways, I would compare them to some of Rembrandt's self-portraits. Jericho certainly looked at Rembrandt. You can see that just by the way he uses light and dark, the way the figures emerge out of shadow. But I think they're on an emotional par with some of Rembrandt's best portraits. For they can speak to us as paintings, even in poor PowerPoint slide form, as lived responses in oil paint on canvas to a unique and particular meeting between people, the painter and his sitter, in some specific place or other, although this isn't, and perhaps it doesn't need to be, spelt out. There are ways in which, through their different and subtle visual idioms, the paintings may have given the sitters something back of themselves, as I suppose one hopes a portrait would. Each uses a painter's way of expressing a personality and an emotional state. Envy, for example, is jumpy. The composition is jumpy, with these sharp, jagged little energetic lines of her bonnet and bits of bonnet ribbon springing out, and she looks like she's about to leap out of the canvas. She could bite you. The monomaniac of military command is, if you were to analyse him, the most geometrical of the portraits. Horizontal eyes, verticals, triangles, as if he's still caught in a battle, in the days when battles were still matters of triangulation and ranks marching in straight lines or wheeling in arcs. He was upright and direct like a soldier, but also looking in a rather terrified way out of the canvas. And as for the gambler, she's in a different register altogether. She's slower, the visual rhythms are slower. She doesn't have that red warning V of the envy figure. She's muted, brown, mousy. She seems weighed down by life rather than at war with it like her sister. They may have been therapeutic acts in themselves for painter and for sitter. And this is a possibility, among other possibilities which I touch on in the book. I think they can be therapeutic for us too. They do something to us. But there's also a historical and even a political value in engaging with these paintings. For those of us who think there's something very important about this place we're in, the Anna Freud Center and the Freud Museum, they point to some roots of psychoanalysis, aspects of its essential prehistory, in fact, the historical preconditions for it. Not least simply because of their unprecedented nature. as representations of madness. Nothing like this has ever been painted before, in that they show ordinary people, albeit clearly troubled and preoccupied, and not meeting our eyes, but not doing mad things. In the kind of at-one-remove theatrical setting that the 18th century had provided for such things. And of course, as you'll know, Bedlam and the great mental hospitals that's an anachronistic word I've just used, the great asylums of Europe, were also zoos in the sense that people paid to go and watch the loonies and their animal antics. For madness, up to around this period, was indeed thought of as a sort of animal state, a return to nature, and not always a very kind one. We see it in Hogarth. Here's Hogarth's famous scene from A Rake's Progress of the early 1730s. Famously in Goya, the yard of a madhouse in Saragossa, painted in 1794. But this, what Jericho is doing, is not madness as spectacle. We're not at the zoo anymore. Nor are we allowed to be mere disengaged or amused or titillated or excitedly frightened spectators. They don't offer us that kind of narcissistic gratification. Historically, they register something really different. Now, how we see and approach the paintings may also be modulated by our attitudes to this history, the history of madness in psychiatry, and or the beginnings of psychotherapy, because it's a very contested history. It's a politically hot history. No historian of madness or psychiatry, of course, can ignore Michel Foucault and his Histoire de la Folie, his Madness and Civilization, which was published in 1961. That book's really, really set the tone. No historian can not engage with it. For Foucault, the revolution in the care of the insane that was underway across Europe in the years on either side of 1800, and we'll talk more about that in a second, in Foucault's analysis, was the delivery of the mad from one form of confinement to another. On the one hand was what Foucault called the great confinement, the locking up of the mad from the mid-17th century onwards, where the mad were, as I said, treated in animal conditions, often absolutely unspeakable conditions. On the other side, though, was far from a liberation, was a new form of confinement. This is Foucault's thesis, very crudely. A confinement under a regime of psychiatric mastery. And under that, Foucault would have included psychoanalysis too. A new kind of, not quite penal servitude, but a new kind of custodial sentence. Well, is this what the portraits show? Some modern historians have thought so. Or are there other ways of relating ourselves to this history? Might it be a bit more nuanced than this? There's a very interesting alternative history, a sort of challenge to Foucault, which was written by two French historians and psychiatrists, actually, called Marcel Gaucher and Gladys Swain, published in 1880, and translated in 1999 as Madness and Democracy. And that's a book I draw on rather freely in my own book. Might the revolution that was happening around 1800 have also involved a radical opening up of the question of what it means to be human? And the question of madness was the perfect vehicle on which to hang that philosophical question, with all the struggle involved in being human. An opening up which led to treatment with the potential both to oppress, as Foucault said, but also to engage in transformative dialogue. Do the portraits register both these things, and maybe more? As far as modern scholarly readings of the portraits have gone, they've tended to fall between two stools. On the one hand, there's psychiatry, on the other hand, there's art history. For art historians, the titles, the forbidding generic titles, perhaps have been too forbidding. As if art historical commentators have felt, well, we can't really speak about this because we're not the psychiatric experts. That's not to say that art historians haven't said a lot and some very interesting things. For historians of medicine and psychiatry, well, these are paintings. They look more like art than medical illustrations. They're not really our province either. We know what we like, but we don't know enough about art really to speak with any authority. So perhaps neither group has really felt qualified in an age of specialisms, which we inhabit, and which was just coming into being, in fact, in Géricault's own lifetime. At the time the portraits were discovered, the art-science split was well established. And all this, I think, may contribute to the fact that the portraits aren't as well known as they certainly deserve to be. Things were different when they were made. My thesis in the book is that the portraits are a sort of crystallization of a painter's and some doctor's attention and engagement during a brief historical window in which such dialogue was not only possible, but also very live. Dialogue between doctor and painter, and between doctor and patient. It was a hugely generative moment, I argue, which it might reward us to revisit in order to help us rethink some culturally deeply ingrained, but historically and culturally contingent notions of our own. For example, to be mad is the same as to be mentally ill. To treat the mad, we must be scientific, or even evidence-based. Now, such notions themselves, of course, have a history. It's not that we can step outside them, but we can think about them, and think historically. The portraits are also, just to conclude this preamble, and to follow the great German sociologist Norbert Elias, they are nodal points in a great historical, social, cultural network in which, of course, we too are nodal points. How do we find our bearings? Well, the book proposes bringing together the two sets of bearings above, art history and the history of madness or psychiatry. And that's another argument. Is the history of madness inevitably a history of psychiatry? All the while keeping in mind the limitations imposed on us by the fact that we occupy a particular place which inflects our viewpoint, and we can't escape from that. There can be no magisterial overview. That is a fantasy of enlightenment, which I believe was something else Géricault was seeking to prick. But that doesn't mean we can't use our imaginations. Something else on which Géricault and the Romantic generations, in which he's usually said to belong, placed a tremendous premium, and which he asks of us. Well, here he is. Here's the boy himself, in an early, not very competent, but pretty striking self-portrait. Géricault is a sort of late teenage dandy from a very well off, I think, bourgeois family. Born in 1791, he died in 1824, the year after, I think, the portraits were made, at the age of only 33. The 225th anniversary of his birth was last Monday week, the 28th of September. And my book came out on the 28th, which is a very, very pleasing bit of coinciding. Géricault, of course, born in 1791, grew up in the shadow of 1789 and the French Revolution. When Chairman Mao, I think in the 1960s, was asked what he thought the effects of the French Revolution were, he said, "I think it's still too early to tell." The overthrow of the French monarchy, the end of feudalism in France and across much of Europe, and its rigid hierarchies and social certainties, marked the beginnings of the unprecedented and the foundations of modernity. I think most of us would probably agree on that generalisation. Nothing henceforth could be taken for granted. It's hard to imagine ourselves back into feudalism and absolute monarchy, to a world in which everyone knew their place, more or less. that more or less was undermined. We think we know where we are, but we're edgy. We're socially very different beings from then, from 18th century people, and certainly from medieval people. That's not to say that the later 19th century and 20th century didn't seem to throw up plenty of hysterical attempts to create and hold on to new certainties in order to try and make ourselves feel better, to fool ourselves that we know somehow where we are. Jericho's years of creativity were brief, roughly 13 years, and they were intense. They were spent under the last years of the Napoleonic Empire, and then after Napoleon's final defeat at Waterloo in 1815, under the restored French monarchy, which itself was part of a Europe-wide attempt, after the bloodiness of 10 years of war with Napoleon, to put the clock back to the days before 1789, before the revolution, to restore monarchy and all those old certainties, which never worked, of course, but it did produce a very oppressive, repressive period in history, and it's to that that the later Jericho belongs. Jericho's work is distinguished, to my mind, by a trenchancy which is born of acute historical awareness and personal suffering, including periods of his own madness. He was painting in the last decade before the invention of photography, within the dominant Renaissance representational tradition, of course, which itself was only 400 or so years old, in which the integrated three-dimensional individual eye, dwelling in time, space, light and shadow, is secure in his place in an increasingly secular, decreasingly myth-laden world, confident in his domination over it, even if questioning his problematic relationship with it, like Rembrandt did. So, to embrace the insane within this tradition was in itself to pose some very unsettling questions. From the breathtaking start of his career as a painter, Jericho was already asking some radical questions, existentially and pictorially. This is his first great success, the Chasseur of the Guard, Charging, shown at the Salon of 1812. 1812 was the year of the invasion of Russia, and the disastrous retreat therefrom. This officer died later in that year. But what sort of a painting is it? Well, it's very large, 3.5 meters tall. I don't know if many of you will have seen it, but I use the word breathtaking advisedly. It seems to show a hero, but a different kind of hero. Some have said a new kind of romantic, anti-hero. He seems very preoccupied with himself. There's this great external world swirling and whirling around him, a fantastic uniform, an amazing horse, but he's caught up in himself. The great 19th century historian Jules Michelet said of the figure, he makes war by thinking. Il fait la guerre en pensant. Or he's thinking while he makes war. So not only does the painting subvert an idea of heroism, it also does this through its subversion of a visual language. Jacques-Louis David was the great painter of the Revolution and then Napoleon's court painter. French painting was dominated by this man and his neoclassical style. He was Napoleon's number one propagandist. Here's David painting Napoleon on his horse in 1805, Napoleon crossing the Alps, like Hannibal, like a Roman, or like a Roman hero. Now this is a painting that lectures to us. It tells us what to think. Yeah, this is Napoleon. He's pretty great. He's pointing the way forward. There are feelings. His horse looks a bit unnerved, but it's a sturdy steed. It's going to cross those Alps. There's no doubt about that. And we know who it is because his name's spelled out. Not a lot of room for confusion, really. We are meant to come away thinking, yep, Napoleon is the man. And indeed, it might have been foolish to have disagreed at the time. Now, in Jericho, there's none of these certainties. Instead of a sort of neoclassical frieze in which the horse traverses and we can read from left to right, this horse is twisting and turning in space. in David, we could map out the space. You know, there's a measurable distance between that hoof and that. There's a perspective. It's, you know, not that mappable, but it's, gives you the illusion that you could stand in the same world. Whoops, come back to that. Oh dear, there he is. Thanks for asking. But where are we in this one? It's very hard to know where we're standing. I'm not sure we'd want to be standing there. Where are we? The painting also has another hidden sub-question, which is, well, where are we and what do we know? Is this a hero? Is he advancing? Is he retreating? What's more, it's extremely sensual. Fabrics, fur. There's an eroticism about this painting. He gets us to experience something, in other words. It shakes us up and gets us to experience. But let's allow his most famous painting just to, for now, the Raft of the Medusa, to carry most of the weight about what we might need to say about him in this context, about his main concerns. You'll probably, some of you, be familiar with the genesis of this painting, exhibited in 1819. It was a response to a shipwreck, a French frigate shipwrecked off the coast of West Africa, where it was on its way to have a slaving colony, formerly owned by us, by the British, handed over to the French, so they could do their own slaving. The captain of the ship was a royalist appointment. He hadn't set foot on a ship for 20 years. He managed to run the ship aground. A raft was built on which 150 passengers and soldiers were disembarked. The raft was then cut adrift from the boats that were towing it, and this raft drifted about in the Atlantic for 13 days, at the end of which there were 15 survivors. The people on the raft suffered a mutiny. They indulged in cannibalism. There was drunkenness. It was a horrendous experience. So most of the time, as the painting sort of shows, they were at least up to their knees in water. It was a political scandal which almost brought down the government of the day. It says a lot about Géricault's interests and concerns, personal and political. He was interested in the conflicts of the now, in contemporary history, making a great big painting about a really recent event, not Roman history, but contemporary history. He was in opposition to all kinds of constraints against body and against thought. He wasn't alone among Europeans in that. Think of contemporaries like William Blake or Byron or Keats or Shelley in England. And such constraints would have included slavery, colonial oppression, and the corrupt and repressive measures of the restored monarchy. So the painting on that level was a terrible critique and was recognised as such. The state did a very clever thing that states are often able to do. It immediately bought the painting and put it in the Louvre. That defused it. It's another subversion of the dominant neoclassical idiom in painting of neoclassical certainties. It doesn't show heroism. It shows horror, albeit in very sculptural neoclassical bodies. It shows a madness at the heart of rationality, we might say. The neoclassical body, which in that idiom was the embodiment of reason, of sanity, now becomes a vehicle for something else. It's subverted and enlisted to new ends. So there's an implicit critique and as well as an expansion of the visual language of enlightenment in the painting. It also shows his interest in modern, recognisable states of mind in face and body. For example, a grieving father here. There's a whole spectrum, a whole gamut of emotion from grief to hope. The figure at the top significantly is a black figure. There are three black men on the raft. And that was a very, very conscious decision on Géricault's part. Which may have come out of personal guilt. His family money came from tobacco. and it almost certainly rested on slavery. So he was wrestling with something in himself and his own heritage too. He's interested in moments of extreme intensity, extreme emotional intensity, peak moments. And I think there's a further question, a development of the question already asked in The Chasseur Charging. And the question would be this: what in the direst of circumstances survives? And his answer, well, the spontaneous animal life of the body, that does seem to survive. And that's expressed not just in the bodies themselves, but in the whole upward energy of the composition. And this sense of an inherent, even uncanny, aliveness is something that we see throughout his work. In order to make the conditions in which he could make that painting, Géricault put himself through it. This is a study related to the painting, but not a direct study. It's more Géricault behaving a bit like a method actor. He put himself through horrors, visiting the morgue to paint, for example, the heads of recently guillotined prisoners, in order to try and recreate an experience in himself. In Julian Barnes's phrase, to infiltrate the air with mortality. But there's ambiguity in life in this too, even in this study. It's not just horror for horror's sake. These heads could be lovers in bed, by not a great stretch of the imagination. There's an erotic edge to this painting. These expressions of sexual repletion. The man and the woman's head lying on sheets next to each other. This is a very disturbing thought once you get hold of it, and if you get that. And that uncanniness is something that repeats itself across Géricault's later work. He was a huge lover of horses, crazy for horses, as a friend described him. I think this is an extraordinary painting, just the uncanny, inherent aliveness of this animal. It's a horse you would engage with. But then what? So, let's now turn to the other coordinate of my argument, and its complexities. Now, we'll need to jump back in time, though, to the Revolution. We're now going to look at the doctors who were establishing themselves in a new profession, the profession of alienists, as they called themselves, not yet psychiatrists. So let's now look at the medico-philosophical moment. This is the cover of a treatise published in 1801 by Philippe Pinel, who by that time was the doctor in charge of the Salpêtrière Hospital, a beneficiary of the Revolution, soon to be personal physician to Napoleon himself. But this wasn't just one treatise among other treatises of the period, and there were plenty of treatises on madness. Madness was itself a hot topic, not least because the King of England had recently been mad, so had the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition in the late 1780s. Plus ça change. You radical. But this book broke new ground. It became a touchstone, and not just because of Pinel's growing but not yet quite unassailable institutional power. Its subtitle, Medical Philosophic Treatise, note the philosophic, on mental alienation, or la manie, mania. Its subtitle may have resonated for bourgeois contemporaries with what had happened in the previous decade, the 1790s. Revolutionary fervour can seem a dangerous madness in which people literally lose their heads. But it also comes out of the background of the earlier revolutionary moment and late Enlightenment optimism, hence the philosophique. The bliss in that dawn to be alive, which the young Wordsworth described, the early revolutionary projects of total renewal, that there could be a new man, reformable and perfectible through education and the application of reason, freed of priests and superstition, worshipping only at the temple of reason. There was a new calendar, 1792, became year 1, and you'll notice this book was published in year 9, 1801. So a whole new world was being projected by the early revolution. The new Society of the Declaration of the Rights of Man of August 1789, that's just a month after the fall of the Bastille, of liberty, equality and fraternity, proposed a republic of citizens based on the model of the Roman Republic. And this included, probably for the first time in Western history, a public health provision. The nation recognised its obligation to look after the health of its citizens. And it quickly had to accommodate the insane as well. But this was problematic. Physical illness is one thing. Public health and sanitation is one thing. But how do you define who's mad? And how do you distinguish mad people from criminals? Or from victims of tyranny? Perhaps that's what they are. That would be easy if they were all victims of tyranny. Or they may be enemies of the people, in which case they should go to the guillotine. Or they might be aristocrats in hiding, in which case similar. Or they might be malingerers. How do we find out? These questions taxed the new National Assembly and its subcommittees on health very much. There's a story of a committee which visited the hospital of Charenton in 1790, which at that time was still run by a monastic order, the Brothers of Charity. The commissioners who visited it, first to their surprise, found it to be an extremely well-run model institution. But they questioned all 87 of the patients there. They were questioned by a judge and a physician, and all of them were patently mad. Not one of them asked to be released. So what to do with them? This was the Assembly's problem. What to do with the mad? And who to do it? Well, in the book, I attempt to chart this very complicated history. I'm sure other historians may question some of my thoughts in it. The book attempts to chart the relative triumph in a complicated and contested history of doctors as the best arbiters of madness versus sanity. This had not been the case before. Over priests and lawyers, but also alongside lawyers. So doctors, from now on, become both healers and custodians, sorts of jailers. So on the one hand, we have if the public health provision was the idea that all citizens could be citizen patients, how did the mad fit into this? Well, they almost did. But their civil rights still had to be suspended. This was a tricky matter. You know, suspending people's civil rights looks suspiciously like the old regime. One solution was to create a new category. The Marxist historian Robert Castel described it as a system of tutelage, tutelage. You treat them as minors. You suspend their civil rights. You don't treat them quite like prisoners, but they're not full free citizens either. So that was the solution, which was forged by the various agencies involved, lawyers, doctors, etc. It was an impossible attempt to square madness and liberty. What the doctors were doing was also a triumph of enlightened philanthropy on one level and progressive philosophy and its emancipatory drive. The traité that Pinel published proposed a new taxonomy, a new ordering of categories of madness. It put forward new ideas for housing and administration so that observation could be conducted more efficiently and people could be housed more humanely. It also underlined something called the moral treatment, which is something that had come from England and elsewhere in Europe. The idea that the mad can be talked to, can be engaged with. And this was relatively new. Of course, if you were well off and went to a private madhouse, you might have been lucky and found a doctor who would talk with you. If you were one of the mass of the poor, that would not have been the case at all. The moral treatment could sometimes, as a way of trying to engage its patients, involve elaborate theatrical subterfuge, but that might affect permanent change. For example, there's a story that Pinel tells in the treatise of a man who thinks he's being guillotined. There were quite a few people very preoccupied with the guillotine, as you can imagine, in this period. and the wrong head had been put back on him. And he couldn't get this idea, out of his head. But what the cunning doctor does is he enlists some other patients to tell him the story about Saint Denis. So the other patients say, you know the story about Saint Denis? You know, he went round, he had his head cut off too, you know, and the patient says, oh yeah, awful, I'm just like that, you know, I'm bad, it's as horrible for me as it was for Saint Denis. He said, well yeah, well after he'd had his head cut off, Saint Denis kissed his own head. Oh, said the patient. And then, when the other patients burst out laughing and say, you crazy madman, how could he possibly have kissed his own head? Apparently that was a curative moment. He never mentioned his delusion again. Now for Gaucher and Swain in their commentary, this is, you know, something extremely crude, but what it does is something crucial. It opens up the idea of a gap, that there can be a sane part and a mad part. And this isn't just a theory, that it really can act in that way on all of us. In later 19th century historiography, Pinel is the mythic founding father of modern psychiatry, and particularly, of course, French psychiatry, the best. This is a painting of 1878 by a man called Tony Robert Fleury. This is the age of the next generation of psychiatrists. This is Pinel depicted almost like Charcot, under whom Freud studied. The grateful mad ladies look suspiciously like the fetching hysterics of the later Salpêtrière, but never mind. This is the mythic moment in which Pinel is meant to have struck off the chains, liberated the mad from their squalid, awful cells. It's an idealized picture, but it really does give no idea of just how vile conditions were in which mad people were kept. The French contrast was always also a patriotic one. The contrast with the bad old days and with England. This is how they treat them in England. This is a plate from a book published by a Scottish surgeon in 1806. The maniac, chained up. And that's how you recognise a maniac. That's what they do with their faces. So if we compare an image like that to an image like this, there's an immediate striking difference. Pinel's most important pupil, a man called Esquirol, and then his students, under Napoleon and the Restoration, consolidated the hegemony of the alienists and the status of alienism as a medical speciality. It's a development that culminated in 1838 with the definitive French madness law, which was known as the Loi Esquirol. And this stipulated that every département should build an asylum under the absolute authority of a doctor, and it laid down the conditions under which someone might be confined, with the medical expert having the biggest say. And this act wasn't substantially altered, amended, until 2011. That same year, 1838, saw the publication of Esquirol's major book, his illustrated two-volume book entitled Des Maladies Mentales, On Mental Illness. And you can see, just by listening to those two titles, the distance travelled between Pinel's treatise of 1801 and 1838, from a medico-philosophical meditation and treatise, a book on mental illness. That was the shape of things to come. At this point, I need to say something about the monomania, that diagnosis. It was the perfect diagnosis for the moral treatment. If there was a sane part in all of us, but particularly of the crazy, which is untouched by an obsession, then monomania absolutely fitted the bill. But an impressive disease category was also needed politically for the doctor's project. For what is a doctor without a disease, and especially a doctor who doesn't mainly treat the body? This was now the alienist's growing and ultimately insurmountable problem, and it accounts for the brief shelf life of the alienism project, why it only had a brief golden age, and why physical medicine and a psychiatry of organic medicine and of mental illness was to triumph, even if no organic basis was found, now as then. It's interesting that in Britain, because the moral practitioners, such as the philanthropist Tuke from York, were not doctors, they never gained the institutional power that their French counterparts managed between about 1795 and about 1840. So that was the narrow historical window, a matter of three or four decades, within which Jericho's portraits appear. How are we doing? Badly. Gosh. Esquirol's students included Georget, who we've already mentioned, a friend of Jericho, fellow liberal, perhaps his doctor too. He or Esquirol probably commissioned the portraits. I think Georget. Georget worked to put the moral treatment on a firmer footing. He had his own answer to the mad doctor's dilemma. How can we be doctors who don't treat the body? And it was this. He said, well, madness is an illness in its own right, and therefore it's the province of the doctor. And what's more, it's an affliction of the brain. That's definitely physical. However, the proper treatment must directly address the brain. And how do you do that? Well, by talking, by the moral treatment. It was a very canny solution. And I argue quite strongly in the book that is what he was aiming to do against people who think otherwise. But what was the nature of the collaboration between them, if indeed there was one? Art historians have put forward various possibilities. Were these physiognomic portraits? In other words, was the idea that you can study the signs and symptoms of insanity from the features of the face? This was a very, very current idea. Esquirol, in his book of 1838, illustrated it with lots of images like this. A maniac. This, I think, very touching figure is called Abba. His diagnosis was idiocy. And there was a tradition in this mode of illustration, medical illustration, of using rather good artists. This is a man called Gabriel. And the portrait is an officer driven mad by political events. But it's not a fully blown oil painting like this. So something else is going on. They may be physiognomic. There may be telltale signs that we can read. You know, the averted eyes, for example. But that's clearly not all. Were they before and after? Were the lost five portraits the after ones? These are before, or maybe they're after. We don't know. That's one thesis that's been put forward. Were they painted to further the doctor's professional status, particularly Georget's? All the figures were people likely to have run into trouble with the law. Child abductor, thief, envious woman could have done anything. Gambler could have stolen for her money. So they're all people who are likely to have found their way to the courts. Georget played a key role, as Lisa Apignolesi pointed out in her very good book, which is also on sale upstairs, Mad, Bad and Sad, 2008, in arguing in the courts that he was the expert, that he could sway the judgment to keep to put forward the insanity plea, that the court might be committing a crime if it convicted someone to the guillotine who was in fact mad and couldn't help themselves. They were monomaniacs of killing their mothers, that sort of thing. The two materialists, Georget and Jericho, also shared oppositional values, and they can both be seen within the context of romantic protest and identification with the underdog, les misérables, along with other figures like Byron, like Shelley, like Beethoven, whose Ninth Symphony was performed in 1824. All the figures also represent public evils, poverty and theft, ruinous state-sponsored gambling, child prostitution against a background of an exploding birth rate, which led to a Paris full of abandoned children. All the figures seem to be wearing heavy winter clothes. I think in this they echo... I think they're Jericho's Winterreise. Schubert completed Winterreise in 1828, and among the many things it does, I think, is speak to the cold, the icy cold, dull climate of Restoration Europe. And there's a very, very good book about that by Richard Bostick, the singer. Bostridge. Yeah. Fantastic. Ian Bostridge. Wonderful book on the Winterreise. Did Jericho make the paintings for his own therapy? Well, very likely. I mean, what painter, in a way, doesn't? I think the paintings are aspects of all of the above. But really, to grasp the link, I think we need to take a step back again and look from a wider perspective. Above all, they embody the new democratic sense of the human implied in Pinel's traité, that is, available for relationship, echoing the moral treatment. They are therapeutic subjects. We could talk about Hegel now, but at 8 o'clock it's probably a bit late to be talking about Hegel. So we'll skip him. The portraits, think back to the horse. Let's go back to him. Think back to the horse and the raft. I think the portraits are also intimations of an inherent health, an inherent drive in all of us. What we in the 21st century might call a therapeutic urge, or Winnicott in the last century called a therapeutic urge. Something that survives in the direst circumstances. Something perhaps like an unconscious, an embodied unconscious. Madness was a sort of limit case, a test case, and it's not a subject, I think, that Jericho chose by accident, because it enabled him to further his own personal questioning. The question now has become, just what are the minimal conditions for life? What is it about these people incarcerated in Bicêtre or the Salpêtrière? And the answer, again, he finds, is in an inherent libidinal life of the person. So, the portraits, I think, register a profound shift in consciousness and in the nature of subjectivity. The mad no longer have a monopoly on opacity to themselves and others, and the sane have no monopoly on transparency and personal and civic responsibility. Pinel, you know, really did set out to cure people, and some of them did get out and live their lives as citizens. Madness from now on was no longer absolutely other, but, in spite of what Foucault says, to be engaged and dialogued with, both outside and inside ourselves. For the discovery of the error was that we are all alienated. We are all estranged from ourselves. We are constitutively split. This, I think, is Jericho and the alienists' discovery. Or it's certainly what Jericho intuited and echoed in his paintings. It's what it really took Freud finally to establish, that we're divided against ourselves, no longer masters in our own houses. And this is a position perhaps stated most explicitly among all Freud's major followers by Jacques Lacan. We are split subjects, constitutively caught up in misrecognitions of self and other. What might Georges have found in Jericho's portraits? Well, I think he might have found, or I'd like to think anyway, that he might have found a reflection of a therapeutic commitment to attach himself to the ordinary individual at the moment of his greatest alienation from himself and others, with an awareness of that individual's inalienable aliveness. I think I'll stop there since it's 8 o'clock. I hope that gives you some sense of what the book tries to do. There's lots more I could say. Thank you very much for listening. Oh, sorry, Hegel. He insists.
No, I'd go over and you can chat to people.
Well, we've got till 9, have we, Carol? Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe. What about a bit of both? So 5-10 minutes questions. Will that be?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of questions here, and then go and continue the conversation over
them.
Casey.
Oh, sorry. I'm not totally sure whether this is a question. so much as what you were just saying at the end there was really making me think now of our response to people who are refugees, people who have travelled huge distances, what the forces which have made them leave their country, and you know, to do that, do we see that as, in some senses, a state of madness because they're pushed to the absolute extremes, especially when we think of mothers who have sent their young 11-year-olds out, you know, just to get there, you know, get the hell out of here and do what you can to get there. And how do we respond now to those people and how we would respond ourselves in those same circumstances if we were in them?
Yeah. I couldn't agree more with all you're saying. And I suppose in a very small way, I think being able to engage with paintings like this can help us a little bit and give us courage. I say to help us, but you're talking about people in, you know, terrible, terrible situations. How do we respond? Yeah.
Thank you so much. It was a fantastic talk, and I look forward to reading the book. I'm very interested at the moment in art therapy, especially with people with acute psychosis. But there seems to be sort of quite a big split within the psychiatric community about whether the art that is created in these therapy sessions can be exhibited. And I wondered what you thought were the ethical quandaries involved in these paintings.
That's interesting.
Are we intruding upon this person's therapy?
Yeah.
Are they receiving it?
Yeah.
It just brought up a lot of questions for me in that respect, because I believe there is a right, obviously, for the privacy of the patient. But then, of course, for public perception to really open up about mental health, to look at the sort of creations and fantastic art that is made within art therapy sessions, opens up dialogue within society about people who are contained against their will and create sometimes without any knowledge of being in the act of creation. Sorry, but the question more is, do you think there is an ethical quandary in the sense that these people would have consented to their portrait being made? I mean, I guess...
I don't know. Yes, I think there may well be.
Because from an artistic point of view, to get someone to sit, to the extent of being able to create such an oil painting, I'd imagine that they had some consent in...
I would think they would have had to, And there are so many mysteries. We don't... Did the doctor set them up? You know, sit like that. Don't look at the painter because you look more mad if you look that way. That could be. Or did Jericho catch them at that moment of their maximum alienation from themselves? Did they disappear for the reasons, very good reasons you're saying? Did Jericho or Georges think of perhaps they shouldn't be seen in public? Both painter and doctor would certainly have known the names of these people and had relationships with them.
Thank you.
Was it only in France that that word alienation was used?
It was used in England, but I don't think it had such a professional cachet as it did in France. Alienisme. The word psychiatry had already been invented in Germany. But France being France, they wanted a French word. Psychiatrie doesn't really come into use in France until the later 19th century. Hegel, though, we can't avoid him, of course, made a lot of alienation. And some of his ideas certainly came from his study of the French alienists. And the French alienists, in turn, had an idea that alienation wasn't just in the individual, it was also something social and political. So it's a very interesting history.
Time for a drink.
Well, I was going to say, is there a final question? But I think I've been preempted. I think maybe it's time for a drink.
Thank you.
Thank you.